Welcome to Pacific Mammal Research's Marine Mammal Highlight Series. We are a 501c3 research and education nonprofit studying marine mammals in the Salish Sea off Washington State. In this series, you will learn about different marine mammals as we discuss interesting facts about each species. This is our way to geek out, share some information, and have some fun. We hope you enjoy the series, and be sure to follow us on Instagram to vote for which animal we talk about next. And without further ado, welcome to the PacMam podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And so this week's kind of fun. Okay, so last marine mammal highlight, you guys didn't get to choose because Instagram was broken for me and it wouldn't let me do it. This time I did the poll and I was like, great, it worked. And then I went to go look at the results and the poll wasn't there. And so I was like, did the poll even go out? I don't know. What happened? I guess I'll make another one. So I made another poll. And then when I went to go check that one, both the polls were there. So I apologize for making you guys choose twice. But what was super fun is that it was a landslide both times. It was like 85% and 90%, something ridiculous. Like 25 votes to two for the Galapagos. I almost said the wrong one. Galapagos first scale. We'll talk about why that's easy to misdo the names there. But the Galapagos fur seal beat the Galapagos sea lion. It was the Battle of the Galapagoses. So so that is my dog in the background. If you can't hear that, hopefully you can. But I'm not sure what he's barking at. But anyway, so it's the Galapagos fur seal, one in a super duper landslide. So that's who we'll be talking about today. And again, thanks for voting twice, everybody. Oh, thanks for that. Instagram does not like me apparently right now. So with that, so there is the Galapagos fur seal and the Galapagos sea lion are actually very similar. When I was looking for photos to do the two, I was like, okay, wait, is this one actually fur seal? Is this one actually that, like, okay,
so they no, they're very similar.
Someday we'll do the sea lion, but right now we're doing the fur seal. So I will let Kat start with their appearance. They're so cute, and their distribution.
Yeah, they are super cute. So let's start with their distribution. So as you might guess by their name, these guys are endemic to the Galapagos Island archipelago. So basically, this is really the only place that they are found. There is one colony that was recently discovered in northern Peru.
And endemic means, just in case for people who don't know, endemic means that they're only found there. Like they started there, they didn't go anywhere else. That's just where they're at. That's it.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. So yeah. So basically, this is really the one place you're going to find these guys. Mostly they are found on the in the western Galapagos Islands. So again, this is an archipelago, so there's multiple islands in the Galapagos Island chain. So these guys are mostly found in the western islands and typically around rocky shores. They seem to like those kind of more rocky areas. They'll use those as like shade to escape the sun. So the islands that they are most commonly found are Isla Isabella and Isla Fernandina. Those are the most well populated. So these are ones that, like, if you're going to go as a tourist to try to see these guys, these are the ones, the islands that you would probably go to. They're rarely seen at sea, which will kind of feed into, I think, a little bit about maybe how much we know about these guys, that mostly when they are seen, this is on land, when they are hauled out. And kind of, like I said, they do prefer those more shaded, rocky areas when they're on land. The reason for that is due to their appearance. So nice little segue. So these guys, as the name would suggest, again, they're fur seals. So they do have a pretty thick coat. The males have a slightly longer mane. So again, like a lot of fur seals, it's a little bit thicker hair for the males around that neck area. In terms of coloration, these guys are like a grayish brown coat. As again, they are they have external ear flaps. So, and they have large bulging eyes, which I just love that description. I thought that was really funny where the, like, several places I saw like large bulging eyes, like, oh, so they're a little, you know, I don't know. They got big eyes. They're really cute. Oh, Cindy, you're muted. Cindy, you're muted.
Gosh, dang it. Oh, I was trying to hide it from the dogs when they're making noise.
Sorry, what were you saying?
But with the bulging makes me think of that, you know, that lady that went viral on the internet where she can actually push her eyeballs out of her sockets. You haven't seen it? Oh my God.
Oh
Yeah.
no.
She can actually push them out so her like you could see like the ball part of her eye. And so that's what I think of when you say bulging. So it's
Oh no,
not a
I
very
don't want
attractive
to.
name for the spur seals. So I
No,
like
I just like to think
see.
of them as having big eyes.
Yes.
So again, grayish brown fur coat, external ear flaps, and large eyes. And they do have a pretty short snout. So this is important. We'll get to why in just a second. And then another really cute descriptor, they have a small button nose.
Oh.
So very petite, very petite. They are actually, in fact, the smallest of all eared seals.
Yes.
So they only grow, the males only grow up to about 5 feet in length, and the females are slightly smaller at around about 4 to 4.5 feet. So like really small. That's the size of like a harbor seal.
Yeah, that's tiny.
So very small. The pups are kind of a blackish brown. Sometimes they have white or grayish around the nose and mouth areas. And in terms of coloration for the adults, like I said, they all have this kind of grayish brown coat, but the males have a slightly lighter underside. The females and the juveniles have what they refer to as more of like a rusty to tan colored belly and chest. So again, if you are seeing them in the wild, if it's more of that kind of like reddish undertone to the belly and chest, that's likely a female or juvenile. Like I said, it's important to note that they have the shorter snout because these guys are very often confused with the Galapagos sea lion. So kind of funny that and we were talking before we started recording about how interesting it was that you guys were like, no, we want to hear about the fur seal. And they are in a lot of ways very similar looking to the Galapagos sea lion. So they might be confused with them, but a few important differences. So they are smaller than the Galapagos sea lions in general. They have those shorter, broader head than the Galapagos sea lion. So the Galapagos sea lion has a slightly more narrow, elongated head. And the coat is a lot thicker too. So again, especially if you're seeing them on land, which you're most likely to, the coat is going to be a lot fluffier. And they have larger fore flippers than the sea lion. So if you happen to get a view of those fore flippers, then those are going to be longer than the sea lions also.
And oh shoot, I was gonna say something about their appearance and how they're different and now completely went out of my brain. But there was something about their coat. Oh no, the ears, that's it. So I find personally that the fur seals, because fur seals are part of the sea lion group. It's a kind of a misnomer name because they're not actually true seals, they're actually in the Otariids, so they are sea lion grouping.
Little confusing.
Yeah, but the fur seal ears are more cylindrical. Like I feel like they look like little tubes more than the eared seals for of like sea lions. They're just more like flaps. At least that's what I've noticed, like on the Guadalupe fur seal, the northern fur seal that we have up here, and then when I looked at their picture as well. So I think they're more kind of they're just a different shape than regular sea lion ears.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good point to make. And that's about it. That's pretty much all I have. So again, like I said, these guys are found really only in the Galapagos Islands. Grayish brown fur coat. Again, they're pretty small, 4 to 5 feet in length, depending on the gender. And again, the males are going to have that slightly thicker mane. And that's about it.
It's kind of funny because it's like since they're endemic and like, well, that's just where they are. Like most of the
Yeah,
distribution, like there's like they're here and they're here and they go this way or whatever. And like,
I know.
no, he's here.
This is where they're, and I think it's funny too, because a lot of times we do spend more time talking about like variations in appearance based on certain subspecies or like certain areas and whatever. So with these guys, it's pretty straightforward. This is what they look like, and this is where they are. So it's gonna be nice and streamlined.
And I'll be talking about where they are in like the behavior and stuff, but it's interesting because these are tropical sea lion, basically in the sea lions family, and sea lions are generally not in the tropics, so there's some interesting adaptations that these guys have for living there, which is what I'll be talking about. So moving on to then the diet and behavior. This maybe end up being a shorter episode, although we say that a lot and then we end up talking a lot, so it may not be, but there's not quite as much information about these guys than we have for other species, and for kind of relatively good reasons. So for diet, what's really funny is I looked at a bunch of different places, and I didn't try super hard to find like a detailed diet study, but just cruising around, there wasn't much. It was just that they eat fish and cephalopods, so that's the amount of detail I got.
Nice.
They do. They are nocturnal feeders, so they do tend to feed at night, and that's due to the the deep scattering layer type thing. So the prey is coming up closer to the surface at night, so they don't have to dive as far. So their average dive is only about 10 to 30 meters. So a lot of sea lions can dive pretty deep, but those are also much larger animals. So I think the smaller you are, it's a little bit harder to dive as long.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, they might be kind of a little more restricted by their size. Yeah.
But they do spend a lot of time at sea. Their foraging trips can last about 16 hours. So they're like,
Wow.
I'm gone for a while. See you later.
Yeah, so that's like the whole night, like more than a whole night. Wow, interesting.
Exactly. So they tend to spend a lot of time out there. And like other some of the other otariids, they do spend a lot of time in the ocean versus land, but I'll talk about that more in a minute with their behavior. I did find that they have two sounds that they know about when they're foraging, and it's a lengthened growl or a snap or knocking noise. And they don't know what it's for, but they do think it's for helping with foraging, and not communication. So,
Interesting. Okay. Huh. Curious. So I wonder if they're almost using like a fish stun type noise,
Yeah,
maybe,
like just
more like a fish
corralling them
scare
or
noise,
something. Yeah,
right?
I
For
don't
like
know.
the knocking noise. Interesting.
But I
Very
think
cool.
that they're out and about and out so long. Like I don't think there's been that much like following fur seals out into the water and seeing what they eat. So.
That's what I was gonna say, and that's kind of what I was alluding to. These guys are a little more elusive, I think, and so it can be challenging to, I'm not, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how much we actually do know about them for that reason.
And I'll talk about it in a minute, but like they're elusive in that way, but then you're more likely to see them than Galapagos sea lions because the fur seals spend a little bit more time on land than others
Interesting.
do,
Okay.
which is interesting. So I'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But the
Yeah.
last thing about their diet was actually quite interesting is that it is influenced by lunar cycles very strongly. So they will forage longer during the new moon than during a full moon. And if you think about one thing, in the full moon, there's more light, so you're going to be easier seen by sharks and other predators. And then also, the prey may be in deeper water because the way they're following the those light patterns, they're not going to come up during the full moon as much as they do in the new moon when it's darker, and other predators should see them as well.
Wow, interesting. I wonder, does that also would also have to do with like, I know for certain fish species they have kind of those lunar cycles as well, like with their own cycling. So like with what they're feeding on or like how they're reproducing and things like that. Like I wonder if it has to do with that as well.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think it's basically they're influenced by the lunar cycles because their prey is influenced by the lunar cycle for the most part. I mean,
That's
again,
so cool.
being hidden by from sharks and stuff is also better as well as a bonus. But I would think the
Yeah.
driver would have been that the prey are doing that because of whatever bonuses they get from it.
Yeah, interesting.
It's kind of
Very
cool.
cool.
Because lots of times you'll see like, yeah, there's some correlation with lunar cycles, whatever, but this seems pretty strongly influenced by that.
Yeah.
Maybe
Nice.
they're vampires.
Werewolves.
Right?
Were fur
Exactly.
seals.
Yeah, there you go. So in the behavior, there was I like this one website. It was like the they're odd sea lion, otariids, because of these two things. First of all, that they're non-migratory. So a lot of otariids will move back and forth between rookeries or actually migrate, this way or that way. So these are, they stay in one place, so that's unique. And it's the only one that lives and gives birth in a mainly tropical environment, which we mentioned already. So they're the hot tropic sea fur seals, sea lion. And the other one is the large amount of time on land compared to other otariids. So they spend 30% of time on land. And you may not think that that's very long, but in comparison to other sea lion species, that is a fair amount of time. And so that's why you're more likely to see them versus Galapagos sea lions. When they're on land for longer, but then they're still in the water 70% of the time. So it's like you won't see them, but then when you could see them, you're more likely to see them than other species because they hang out longer.
Right.
Kind of,
Interesting.
yeah.
And I'm curious too. So I wonder, like, again, if that's more to do with their size. like they just can't be out in the water for quite as long. Because I mean, there's a lot that I was reading with the appearance in terms of how they basically have to mitigate not getting too hot. Because again,
Yeah,
like
and
you said,
so
they're in the
they avoid
tropics.
heat by they avoid the heat of the sun by, like you said, lying in the shade next to boulders, under lava ledges and caves, and making trips to the sea. So, but I don't think the Galapagos sea lions are that much bigger. And I
Yeah,
don't know how much time they
interesting.
spend on land, but they have more fur, right? So they have a thicker coat than the sea lions do. So perhaps
Yeah.
that's part of it. So it's a
Yeah.
balance. But
Interesting.
yeah. So it's kind of interesting because it's like, yeah, well, okay, if you're so hot, why do you spend more time on land? And then you have to find
Yeah.
these behaviors to go about to avoiding that. So
Yeah, it's interesting.
interesting. But they really like where they live, so that's what they're doing. And so when they're on land, they are in large groups, most of this time is going to be around mating and breeding, right? That's the general thing for pinnipeds that have these kind of large grouping and mating on land. So the males have territories that can be up to 200 square meters, so it's pretty big, and with as many as 6 to 10 females, and they'll do that for about a month. And so we've talked about this before in other podcasts, but when the males are doing this, they're not eating, and when the females are giving birth, they're not eating for a bit. These guys are a little different, but the males are basically holding that territory down for a month without eating. So they've got a there's a lot of risk there, and I'll get to that in a second. It's very interesting. I was going to go to the females. I'm going to segue into the females here real quick and then go back to the cool part about the males. So in those territories, they breed. That's between August and November, which is the cool season in that region. So again, because they're fur seals and they get hot, they like to do this during the cool season, which is opposite of most other things that usually do it in the warm season, because
I was just gonna say, yeah.
babies need warm. So these guys are the opposite. So they resume their estrus about 5 to 10 days after birth, or after they resume foraging trips. So they'll basically spend kind of a week or so with their pups, and then go start going back for foraging trips. Because these guys are different than a lot of the even some other sea lions, and seals, of course, in that they have one of the longer lactations. So a lot of times it's a couple months, or maybe only a month. These guys will nurse for up to 2 to 3 years. Yeah.
I had to unmute myself. I'm like, wait, what?
It's the pups can go in the ocean at 6 months. They find their own food at 12 months, but they will still nurse, like needing that nursing for 2 to 3 years until they
That is
become.
wild.
And I'll get to a minute. The thing that I was going to talk about with the males and this is linked to these environmental factors that are the issue. So when the females go back, they will forage, usually do 1 to 4 day foraging trips, and then staying on shore for about a day with a pup, depending on food and stuff. But what's interesting is that, so they'll resume estrus even after they have a pup. They'll resume estrus that 5 to 10 days after, but they won't get pregnant until that pup is weaned.
Wow.
Because it's really bad for it's called sibling rivalry, where if they have two, then oftentimes the older sibling will kill the younger one, or the younger one will just die because the older one takes all the food. So they really
Oh,
can't
wow.
have that overlap at all. So they just don't.
That's fa that okay, that makes a lot of sense too when we get to the threats. This will make a little bit more sense. Wow, I had no idea. That's
Yeah.
crazy.
Isn't that crazy? And so then and so that this longer lactation is linked to these environmental conditions like El Nino events, because that long lactation allows them to buffer. If there's bad times, there's still time to do that, and then not getting pregnant while you're still nursing one allows you to make sure the one survives.
So it's
So
basically like you're literally putting kind of all of your eggs in one basket and really nurturing that pup to give them the best possible chance before investing in a new pup. Okay.
right. And because the environmental conditions are so variable in that area, which I think is what you're
Yeah, we'll
alluding
talk
to
about.
and what I'm going to talk about in
Yeah.
a second too, that's their the evolution of the adaptation that they have to that. And so and they do see longer lactation when food is scarce. So they'll just
Okay.
keep it going because the baby's not going to find enough food. So she can still get, she can get it. She can get the milk to them, you know, that kind of thing. So for the males, which is, this is fascinating. So due to environmental factors, which kind of what we just talked about, this variability, and especially with food going up and down in this area, they're not very efficient at protecting females in their territory, unlike other sea lions. And so it is very common that other males are able to successfully mate on a rival male's territory, which normally, like, they're sneaky males, right? That's a thing. But normally it's like, it's a small percentage, but I think with these guys, it's much more common.
Interesting.
And so this is fascinating. So those environmental factors where you have these, this, the, in that area, you have more fluctuations in good years and bad years of food availability and things like that. And lots of this has to do with El Nino, right? So this, the oscillations in every couple of years really really have an impact on the ecosystem and the food web there. So due to the El Nino event of 1982, adult
Oh, yeah.
territorial males were driven to nearly 100% mortality because of food supply. Like, they
Yeah,
because
we'll
they
talk more
couldn't,
about that in the threats.
yeah,
Yeah.
they couldn't last the month that they needed to defend their territory because they didn't have enough food to survive it, which is just crazy.
Yeah.
And then
It's a
in
pretty risky
another,
strategy.
yeah, and in another paper said 30% of the adults and almost all the seals under the age of 4 died. Like, that's huge. So if you have these big crashes, like, that makes sense that you are going to nurture that one pup and make sure that it lasts longer and that you can make sure that they survive through these fluctuations that happen. El Nino and La Nina years, they fluctuate every few years. So you're going to get these ups and downs. So it's very interesting to see that evolved in their behaviors to adapt to that, since they want to stay in this crazy place.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And yeah, like I said, we'll talk a little bit more about that in the threats, because that is actually one of the main ones for these guys, is really just that environmental variability.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that huge crash. I mean, well, so for, yeah, and then you'll talk about threats because they're fur seals. So obviously, there was some hunting there. And then they
They're
have
threats.
these, like these other, they have continually these large population crashes that are going to be an issue for long-term survival. And so the other thing I had was that they communicate with vocalizations and through visual displays, which is pretty common. Did you have something? Do you have anything on predators for the threat section?
I mean, I have that they yes, I have a few predators listed here.
Okay, well, I have one that I wasn't, you probably found, but it's an interesting one. So I'll wait and pop that in if you don't talk about it then.
Okay, we'll talk about that in the threats.
Okay, so last thing, the females are sexually mature at 3 to 5, and the males are sexually mature at 7 to 10, and that's pretty common because if you are a territorial species, territorial species where the males have to fight other males for that territory and defend it, you have to be bigger before you can basically do that. So takes a little bit longer. I'm just gonna throw the lifespan out here real quick because I thought it was funny. They didn't say it in years at first. They're like, the normal lifespan is 264 months. And I was
Wow.
like, that's like, we always talk as parents, we always talk like, first when you're babies, it's like, oh, my baby's 1 month, 6 months. And then after two, you're like, okay, now it's just years. But we always
Right.
joke, like, what if we did that for humans? Like, well, I'm 452 months old. Why did they give it in months? I don't understand. But it makes that evens out to 22 years. It's
Okay. I was going to say, because I saw a couple that were like very wide-ranging lifespans. So I was like, I'm curious what you found. Because I think the one that I found was like, one said like 10 years, and then the other one said like 24. And I was like, I'm guessing this is somewhere in here in the middle.
somewhere,
But if
right?
they're only sexually mature at like 7 to 10, then I would guess, yeah, it's closer to
It's
the
gotta be a little bit
22.
longer. Because if they're waiting till 10 and they die at 10, well, they're not gonna
That's
survive.
pointless. Yeah.
Right? And I think most pinniped species are 20 to 30 years. Like, that's pretty average.
Seems pretty standard.
I did find that they sweat when they get too hot. Interesting. Yeah, which
Yeah.
a lot of those
Makes
animals
sense.
don't do. Yeah.
Good adaptation.
Yep. And they do a similar thing with like other otariids where they use the countercurrent exchange system and the flippers to heat up or cool down as needed. But yeah, that's what I found. So they're very, very tightly tied to the environmental factors in that area, whether it's lunar cycles or oscillations in weather over years, to su be successful in this hot tropical environment with their giant fur coats. So With that, we will take a quick break and get back with learning more about that those kind of threats and then some interesting new research that I was able to dig up. So we will be right back. Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy. And we are back. All right, so tell us what's going to kill all these animals.
I know, I always get to share the best parts. Okay, so in terms of their overall status, let's start there. So these guys are listed by the IUCN Red List as endangered. The estimated population number is about between 10 to 15,000, so pretty low. Again, unfortunately, based on their very restricted location, that kind of makes sense, right? They don't really have the capacity to spread out around the globe like some other species that we've talked about. So yeah, we're looking at about 10 to 15,000 individuals as far as we know. They are currently protected under Ecuadorian law. And I'll talk about a little bit more about that in just a second. And also the special law of the National Park and Galapagos Marine Reserve. So again, there is some protection afforded to these guys, which is fantastic.
And I have some, one of the research things about the reserve and how well it's working. So,
oh, fascinating. Okay, perfect. That'll be really interesting. Okay, cool. So why do we need this protection for these guys? Let's talk about it. So getting into the threats, as we alluded to, these guys have a fur coat. And if you have listened to any of our other podcasts, you will know that fur coats likely make them very attractive to people who want their pelts. So that was, of course, the same situation, unfortunately, for these guys. So their populations were honestly decimated in the 1800s. Again, that was when the, you know, exploration was much more popular. People were able to access these islands all of a sudden that hadn't been able to get to them for a very long time, just with their travel of capabilities. And by the early 1900s, the Galapagos fur seals were thought to be fully extinct. So, I mean, it was to that point that they thought that they were completely gone, that they'd been hunted out. Ironically, it may also be due to their fur that they survived because they prefer those shaded areas like caves and crevices because they get too hot and they hunt at night. They think that that might actually have helped them to survive a little bit more because they were not around when the hunters were present.
And we talked about another seal or a species that did that, not necessarily in the exact same way, but it wasn't the monk seals that they
I think
did
it was the monk
caves,
seal.
Right? Yeah. So they started this kind of risky thing where they're going in these caves where sometimes the pup dies because the water comes in, but that's where they were hiding from all the people and that allowed them to survive. So interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And I don't know if for these guys, if that was a learned behavior, but it sounds like it's more of like, again, that kind of thermoregulation process, but that may actually have really helped them because they were harder to find.
It's a nice benefit to the natural behavior.
I know, exactly. So because of that massive hunting effort, they were I believe hunting was finally prohibited by Ecuadorian law in 1934. And then again, that additional protection was introduced in 1959 when the Galapagos National Park was established. So there are provisions in place for them to no longer be hunted for their pelts, which is fantastic. There is still some concern around human impact with tourism and things like that. And then some more sort of secondary effects of human impact a little bit. But there's no longer really that risk of direct hunting for their fur.
And I've heard from other people who have gone to the Galapagos and who have you know been there, like it's pretty tight. Like they do a better job with regulation there than a lot of other places around the world. So that's something that benefits the animals there for sure.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Awesome. We talked a little bit about predation earlier. So they are occasional prey to killer whales and sharks, but the most prominent predator is actually feral dogs on the
I thought that was
islands.
crazy. I was like, wait, what? How did dogs get there in the
Yeah.
first place? Like, why is there a
Right?
dog there?
People.
Well,
People
true.
bringing their dogs, and then their, I mean, it's the same thing as, again, when people were coming there with their ships, you know, it's the same way as rats get onto islands that were not able to get there, and cats get onto islands that weren't able to get there. So I really didn't know that. I wasn't aware that feral dogs were a big problem, but apparently that is like, that's the biggest risk of predation for these guys is being killed. And again, they're small, right? So, I mean,
Yeah.
it'd be, they're probably the same size as some of those dogs.
Yeah, I was like, wait, what? Like, you would think that in a place where there's you're close to humans, or I mean, you're close to humans there, but like, it's gotta work to get there. It's not like just like on the shores of California, you know? Why?
But I think a lot of us have this possibly naive perception of the Galapagos Islands as being this very unspoiled, like it's just how it was when Darwin discovered them, you know, or like when we went, didn't discover, but when Darwin went there, you know. I don't think it's like that, to be quite honest. So yeah, I didn't realize that was an issue, but apparently that's actually a pretty big concern for these guys. And I would imagine a lot of the other Phocid and pinniped species there as well, in those areas. So the other human-related one that I have here is plastics. So again, like a lot of other podcasts, these guys are at pretty big risk for marine plastic and debris. Again, this can either be through direct entanglement, ingestion, which I think is becoming more and more of an issue, especially as animals that you know are spending a lot of time in the ocean are feeding on fish. So they're grabbing things that they perceived to be fish, which are in fact plastics. And then, of course, microplastics becoming more and more of a concern as well, building up in their system. So, this is something, even again, and this is what we consider or think about as kind of an unspoiled, untouched region. This is still impacting these animals. And I saw on several different websites has been listed as more and more of a concern. So, I think this is something potentially just with the ocean currents there too, they might be more prone to getting plastics washed in there. But yeah, something to consider.
And such a good point of that, again, back to your point of like, we think of the Galapagos as this untainted, wonderful place that's away from everything, that's untouched. But it isn't, you know, like
Yeah,
plastics are
we're
there
all
too.
connected.
Just like they're here. It's one ocean. Those currents are going to bring it over there too. So it's a good reminder that like, if it happens there, if it ha you know, like it's a problem.
Yeah, 100%. Next threat, again, we already talked a little bit, but let's talk a little bit more about that climate change and climate cycling. So again, these guys are at risk of climate change and ocean warming, for all of the same reasons that we already talked about, right? So that's going to impact their food supplies, it's going to increase the sea surface temperature, it's going to potentially increase it or shift the weather patterns, which is already a little bit unstable for them in the first place. But the second one are these natural climate cycles through El Nino and La Nina years. So specifically El Nino cycles, these guys are very, very susceptible to because of that ocean warming during that process. So again, this is going to reduce the food availability, increase risk of starvation. This is also potentially, again, going to have knock-on effects to how they thermoregulate, whether or not they can actually get cool enough during the day, and that's, you know, that has kind of a secondary impact on their overall well-being and their immune function, all of those things, and their energy levels.
Like wearing a parka in the summer. Like, if you keep that
Right.
on, you're gonna overheat. It's gonna be a
Yeah.
problem.
Yeah. I mean, heat stroke is a real concern, right? So if you can't cool off efficiently enough, and if you're not getting the right amount of food because your food is being impacted by the sea temperatures changing as well, no bueno. So yeah, like Cindy said, I mean, the biggest crash they've had to date that was recorded was that 1982 to 1983 cycle where almost all of the young fur seals were killed, along with about 30% of those adult females and non-territorial males, and almost 100% of the large territorial males. So like a huge, and this is, remember, this is like about almost, you know, probably, you know, 50 to 70 years after that massive crash due to the hunting. So they'd only kind of just started to come back up and they were just starting to get a foothold, and then a huge, like literally almost a full population crash. Absolutely crazy. And so again, these are natural cycling events. These are not necessarily impacted by climate change, although they are interacting with climate change. And so some of these cycles can become more extreme with in global warming and global climate change in general as well. So pretty intense location to choose to subsist in.
It's pretty kind of risky. Like they oh, and so this I wanted to point out is, like in the tropics, it is kind of oligotrophic, which means like there's not a lot of nutrients there. But in certain places, there's this upwelling current that occurs, and this is one of those where there's this. It actually is quite highly productive, which is why these animals can survive there because of that location. But those are susceptible to the changes in weather, those El Nino and La Nina oscillations that change that dynamic. And so you get these fluctuations in the years. So like they're in a not nutrient rich place, but has a nutrient rich pocket that then gets shifted depending on the weather. So it's really variable. So yeah, it's a very dicey place to live, especially in a warm place with a parka on. So I'm not
Yeah, I
really
know.
quite sure.
I'm very impressed that these guys have managed to persist as long as they have. The final threat that I will say kind of relates to that a little bit nicely, actually, which is really just the threat of being a closed population, right? So because they have experienced some of these massive drops in population, which we refer to as biologists as a population bottleneck, right? Where the population declines to where there's very few individuals left, and then they breed amongst themselves, and then the population recovers. That has inherent risks with it as well in terms of recessive genes becoming more dominant and just in terms of like overall fitness level for the animals. So again, this limited range, low population size may make them more susceptible to things like disease outbreaks or inbreeding, and just those other issues that do come with living in such a limited location with a low population size. So just something to kind of bear in mind, that's kind of just a background threat for these guys all the time, just because of their lifestyle and where they live, and these massive population depressions that they've experienced.
Yeah, the hallmark of biology is genetic variation is good. Genetic variation is good because it allows there to be options of animals that can survive in different as things change. And then there also is the thing of inbreeding, right? So if you have that genetic bottleneck, you're breeding with your family members, basically. The one thing that I'll say that is interesting about that is that it doesn't always mean a death sentence. So sometimes it does. Sometimes you have bad genes, and then all you have is bad genes, and you're basically that's it. Like you're done. But for some populations that have been inbred basically for so long, and I'm specifically talking about the vaquita in the Gulf of California, and they're even talking about that with the southern resident killer whales up here. If you have been inbred for long enough that the genetic variation is already low, you've already filtered out all the bad genes. And so the genetic variation is not necessarily going to be an issue for your long-term survival. If you don't have genes that allow you to change with the environment, then that's a different story. But the bad deleterious genes that get caught and stay in a small population that then hurt the population. If those aren't there, then that portion of the genetic issue isn't there. So hopefully that's true for them. I don't know if it is, but
Yeah,
I
that's a
mean,
really good point, though.
I feel like it is after so many population crashes that they're still
I
around.
was going to say, these guys have some kind of inbuilt safety mechanism, it feels like, that they can survive. I mean, and again, that's the interesting thing. If they're navigating and coexisting with these massive climate cycles, they've got to have something that would allow them to perpetuate and to continue to survive through that. So yeah, pretty interesting.
Very cool. So, for the new research, a lot of it actually does maybe link to climate change. So I'm actually gonna start with that, and then I'll go to the other ones. But I started with one, and then I was like, and I found two more. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I gotta talk briefly about all of these. But the first one is Páez Rosas et al. At 2017. This was the northernmost record on Pacific coast of North and South America. It was a 2016 subadult male sighted in. For was it an E Erandira Beach in Lázaro Cárdenas, Michoacán, Mexico? So basically Mexico. I don't know. That had like three different locations. But that was the farthest north as it had ever been seen, and this may be related to anomalous temperatures in the Pacific at the end of 2015 and 2016, which decreases the primary productivity, forcing the animal to travel farther to find food. Right. So that variation.
Interesting.
And there was unusually high frequency of strandings of marine mammals at the same time, cetaceans and
Yeah.
rosas. So that might be that.
Interesting. Yeah.
So then I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. Oh, wait, there's another one. Quintana Rizzo et al. 2017 was the first fur seal seen in Guatemala. So in June 2016, similar time, again, a live fur seal stranded, subadult male. See the trend going here. And that's the first record in the Pacific coast of Guatemala and in the Central America region. And then Tamayo and Milan et al. Had the molecular ID of the first fur seal on the central coast of Oaxaca in Mexico. Is that right? Mexico.
Think so. I'm pretty sure it's
Countryside.
Waka. Yeah.
Oaxaca. This was made 2019. It was a yearling, so again, young. There were four occasions that were sighted. One was injured, that was taken in. And apparently, juvenile fur seals are just really hard to tell the difference between them in just by looking at them. It's harder as juveniles to do that. So they took molecular, they looked at the genes. And it did say that it was an actual Galapagos fur seal. And that may be related to the high sea surface temperatures associated with an El Nino year. Again, so these walkabouts that these young males are doing are likely because of these oscillations, and then also which can then intercorrelate with climate change. And if climate change happens more and more, then these guys are going to probably start stretching out where they're going because of just the food collapses that happen. So definitely, I'm definitely a risk if we're
Interesting.
seeing these changes happening, these males wandering about the ocean.
The ocean.
So then the other one was I found Lopez et al. 2015. This is looking at the matrilineal population structure. So they looked at mitochondrial DNA, which you inherit from your mother, and then microsatellites on the nuclear DNA, which comes from both. And they found similar levels of genetic diversity to other pinniped species, which is interesting since we were just talking about that genetic bottleneck, despite the severe exploitation and population crashes from El Nino. So they basically have kept
Wow.
the genetic diversity similar to other pinniped species, even though all that happened.
That's wild.
Yeah. So I don't know. I guess the quote unquote right ones died that had the same genes, so that just kept the ones that had the different genes. I don't know.
Oh, that's really interesting though.
Yeah, so I don't know what they've got going on in their genes, but it's pretty good. They did find that there was strong fine scale matrilineal population structure. So 33.9% of the variation in the mitochondrial DNA was basically partitioned among the colonies that were within 70 kilometers from each other. So they're all right there, like they're not going far. And so that translates into this fine scale genetic population structure that we've been talking about. The natal filopatry, which means basically you stay where you were born, of the females translates into this fine scale population structure in this highly mobile species. Like they can go wherever they want. And males do. Males take longer trips and go to places. But it is very much restrained by the females to the area that they're in.
I guess maybe that helps a little bit if the females are not traveling around as much. You're not mixing, like the males are really creating that genetic diversity by moving around, but the females are staying put, so they're not moving and intermingling with other females as well. You know what I'm saying? Whereas like if you have that more fine scale, I could see why that might maintain a little bit more diversity
Well, and it
potentially.
would be different if the males were staying too, because then there would be more,
Correct.
like the diversity
Yeah.
would decrease, or it should.
Yeah.
Never
Yeah,
say
that is
never.
interesting.
Yeah. So at least you got one of the sides going out and mixing up the genes. It's important. So Chavez et al. In 2022 did another population genetics and looking at phylogeography, right? So how they are related to the geography area. They looked at rookeries on four islands, so there were nine total rookeries, and they found three clusters with asymmetric gene flow. So basically, there's some there was some flow in between them, but the other ones, like nope, like these are just they just stay within here. So again, kind of going to that, like they do mix up, but not a lot either. So I don't know what's going on with these guys. They're kind of magic.
How interesting.
Yeah, so they found marked structuring of the populations are likely due to interplay between long-term site fidelity and long-distance migration in both males and female individuals, probably influenced by varying degrees of marine productivity. So the thing that may be hurting them may also be helping them and pushing them to go out and spread those genes in different ways.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's like it's not good for you, but also good for you in terms of population
It's
genetics.
the balance, right?
Right?
The
Exactly.
risky strategy.
Yep. Well, and then you want to keep, if you're in a certain area and that's really working for you, you want to keep the genes there, right? So the females are keeping maybe those good ones that are like, I know how to survive on this island, and the males are moving around and mixing up some of the
Right,
other
introducing
things.
more variation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow,
So
fascinating.
totally. This is Rio Frio, Lazo, and Paez Rosas et al. 2021. Galapagos sea lions and fur seals adapted to a variable world. So this is talking about both species, but they live in the tropics with that high environmental variability in oceanic disturbances equals unpredictable marine productivity, which is what we've been talking about this entire time, right? They in order to live there, they have reduced the overall body size and energy requirements. That's probably why they're small. The limited food supply means they have longer lactations than most other species, Odorias at least. The trophic specialization they have, they don't they're pretty specialized, the sea lions versus the fur seals, so they don't overlap too much. But they have a high level of flexibility, so that reduces the interspecific competition. And then combine that with prey switching during El Nino events. So they're flexible, right? They're plastic. They can be like, oh, there's my regular species isn't here because of the stupid El Nino. I'll eat these other things. But they're both flexible and they both do it in ways so that they don't compete.
Genius.
Yes, I know, right? Like, no, they're not thinking about this necessarily, but it's
No, but
genius.
that, I mean, that makes sense. Like, right, finding that balance so that you can both coexist in that pretty challenging environment.
Yeah. It's like,
Really
well,
cool.
we can work together by not working together
Yeah.
to survive.
We can coexist.
Exactly. And so the moms adjust their length of foraging belts in response to the fluctuations in food, which I kind of mentioned earlier. And this is just a very basically we've talked about all these points, but this paper was kind of summing them all up, meaning like the natural climatic variation of the ecosystem is an important stress factor on their populations, which drives that evolved behavior that they have, which is just, it's really neat to just see that kind of like, yep, that's what's happening.
Yeah, and I think that's, again, that's kind of what a lot of us associate with the Galapagos, right? Is these very interesting case studies where you can see very a lot more clearly than in certain other species what's creating those drivers, what is actually the main impact or the main stressor that's pushing this. So, yeah, really interesting.
Exactly. And so the last one I have is going back to the marine reserves. And so this is Ventura et al. 2019. And it says minimal overlap with conservation zone of marine reserve and fur seals. So the Galapagos is protected under the Galapagos Marine Reserve, right? So, and they recently redefined the zones within the reserve. So there's a large reserve. So they're all the their populations are within that reserve, but within there are zones that you can do different things in. So some you can fish, some you can do that. You're right. There's some you can't go at all. Some you can do this. So it's really important that the zones that you're trying to protect the fur seals in have the right protections, right? So what they did is they went through to look at kernel distributions and habitat modeling from tracking data that they had from over 2 years and three different environmental scenarios. So they looked at it during a cold year, during a warm year, and during an El Niño year. Or like cold season, warm season, El Nino year, that kind of thing. They identified hotspots of pinniped usage and ID'd, and then looked at the predictions of what good habitat patches would be for these animals. So where are they going? Okay, that's where they like to go. These are good habitat patches. This is in this location where those habitat patches are that should be protected. And so they used those together to do a spatial prioritization analysis to define the areas of high conservation priority, and then overlap those with the marine reserve and the zones that were recently redefined and recalculated. Interestingly, they found fur seals used mostly offshore deep waters and more heterogeneous space usage compared to the sea lion. So they were more varied in what they did versus the Galapagos sea lion. The three key areas of high conservation priority that they identified through this analysis were all within the marine reserve. Great, step one. But they overlapped only 8% with the conservation zones.
Interesting.
So the largest proportion of the key pinniped foraging habitat in the Western Archipelago will not be protected from licensed activities in the sustainable use zone, particularly fishing and boat traffic.
Wow.
So this is, I thought this was a great example of something that great is being done, but not correctly, right? They have a reserve, they are trying to protect it, they're doing these zones so that humans can still use areas but still protect animals, but they're not, it's not right. It's the they have not protected the right spots for the fur seals because, you know, and maybe they didn't have the data that this paper now did. Maybe that's changed since now. That was 2019, so that's, you know, 5 years ago. Hopefully they've used this data to maybe redefine the zones again. I didn't see any other papers, you know, updating it. But it just so shows the importance of research for conservation, and you can do something great and have it not be effective
Yeah.
because you're not doing, having the right data and doing the right things, even though you're.
And I think also just really highlights how important it is to be looking at the ecosystem, right? You know, especially when you're talking about any kind of management conservation, like what is the ecosystem that these animals need, that they're dependent on, that they're interacting with the most frequently? Yeah, wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, 8%, that's not going to do anything. Like, so you're spending all this money to do this reserve and have these zones, and then you're not actually effectively doing, like, again, biologically meaningful measures, right? That is a great symbolic gesture of protection, but it's not biologically meaningful for the animals, and therefore is not doing what you're actually wanting it to do.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So, but those are very interesting. So these guys are just a little enigmas, a nuggets of interesting weirdness
They're
living in
super
the
cute.
tropics.
Go check them out if you haven't
Yes.
already Googled them, or if you're not
Little
watching this on YouTube, go check it.
silly
They
people.
are genuinely really cute.
They are very cute. But they got this short little nose and little
The
ears and
button
little
nose.
ears.
Your button
Adorable
nose.
button nose. Button. So with that, we will leave you with our lovely fur seals, Galapagos fur seals, and I'm sure eventually we'll get to the Galapagos sea lion, which will probably have very similar information but different because they are different than these fur seals. But really interesting interplay. So with that, we will leave you for the next episode. We will be going back to either a general review or a topic. We're not sure. So if you have something that you want us to talk about that's recent and interesting, please show it, email us or put it on our social media channels. We'd love to hear from you. Don't forget to go to our new website and look at the merch store. And we have more options, hoodies and things like that for that. And if you feel like you'd like to donate, please do so. That is very helpful for us to keep. We're a small nonprofit, so all the funds go back to our research and helping us teach all the interns that we have coming through and involving the community and with our volunteer program and getting the research done that is important for helping the harbor porpoises and harbor seals here in the Salish Sea. So with that, I think that covers everything. And hope to hear from you so that you can tell us what we want to talk about. Otherwise, we'll find something cool and we will talk with you next time.
Sounds good.
Bye.
See you later.
Bye. This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To learn more about the species we discuss, check out our blog. Head to our website, www.pacmam.org, that's PACMAM.org, to check it out. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.